This podcast is part of the Dark Myths Collective. Visit darkmyths.org to discover more shows like this one. The darkness awaits.
Hello and welcome to the Not Alone podcast. I'm Samuel Fredrickson.
And I'm Jason Moisoso.
Hey, Jason.
Sam.
How are you doing?
I am probably better than you right now.
What? Why?
Because I get to talk about a cryptid, and that's exciting.
Yeah, cryptids are your favorite.
I love cryptids.
Well, I'll talk about this at the end of the show, never mind. But yeah, cryptids are... I think I always say this every time we cover a cryptid, which is, on this episode, we're just going to have a return to good old-fashioned cryptozoology, which is really something that captivated both of us, I think, as children. You, maybe a little more so.
Dude, I watch, like, every version of Monster Hunter, or Monster Quest, or Animal X from Discovery Channel growing up. They all had like, two seasons, maybe. So it's like,
yeah. Why did they keep making the same show over and
over? They just kept rebranding it every couple years. But you could do that and still probably knock all of them out within a 2-day span if you watched them all.
So
super
okay.
Low quality. It's wonderful.
All right.
But the great thing, it inspired something else. Imagination. What's still out there?
Wow. As cryptozoologists often like to make the point, there are a lot of animals aren't known to science, and there have been throughout the years. I think the most famous one is the Komodo dragon, where people went to these islands and they were like, oh my god, there's this giant beast and it's got fangs and it moves super quick and it wrestles with itself. Well, because that's how they fight, is they like wrestle, right?
If I remember,
they're
right,
a they very like... hands-on.
Yeah.
Situation.
Well, so the largest species of monitor lizard.
Let's freaking get this going, nerd.
They get up to like 9 feet long. Their running speed, I think, is somewhere around 30 miles an hour. Ugh,
that's terrible.
But it's short bursts because they're ectothermic, just like every other lizard. So they...
That mean cold-blooded?
Yeah. They get their energy essentially from the environment around them. So they actually use venom and also just have really, really bad bacteria in their saliva in order to essentially deal some sort of lethal blow and then track their prey later on.
Dang. See?
That's going to be important later.
Okay. Jason's got it with the lizard facts over there.
Monitor lizards are super cool. I wanted one for a long time.
Can you have them?
Yeah. So one of the more common ones here in the States is the Argentinian tegu, which is a pretty big lizard. I think they get about 3.5 to 4 feet long.
Oh my goodness.
But they are essentially babies. Like they are the lap dogs of the reptile world.
Okay.
And I can feed them chickens.
Oh my god.
And that, my friend, is the cool part.
No, that's terrible. Who would want that?
As soon as I get the ability to put like the heated floors in my bathroom, I might just get one anyway.
Oh, my God. All right. Okay, good. Well, Jason is a mad scientist.
But Rocco, so, I mean, there's flip sides to it. Anyway.
Amassing a lizard army over there.
Modern lizards are cool, people.
All right, I believe it. And it's that kind of enthusiastic spirit regarding creepy, crawly creatures that has led cryptozoology through the ages to make some really startling discoveries.
I mean, one of my favorites is probably the Pac-Man frog. Which was
what
his
does
name?
That mean?
It's a frog. I believe it's South American. I want to say it's South American. Anyway, it's a frog that its face is literally 1/3 the size of its body, and it's really, really round. It's also a very popular pet as well. But it's called the Pac-Man frog because its mouth is so large that it was named after the video game.
That's something else. Thank you for that secondary burst of enthusiasm.
Which, I mean, that was a discovery in the 80s.
Yeah.
And now we've already semi-domesticated them.
Yeah.
I mean, we sell them at pet stores all the time, so like that's 40 years difference. That's pretty impressive for us.
That is. Yeah. Our ability to pervert nature has just really, really ramped up in the last few centuries.
Now you just made me sad. Yeah. Anyway.
So the point I've
this
been...
This one I probably don't want to bring home.
Yes. The point I've been trying to make is that the cryptid that we're going to talk about today is unlike a lot of the other cryptids that we've covered on the show. It can't
It's
teleport.
Unlike any animal.
Well, I mean, yes. But usually when we cover cryptids, we do so because they are inherently, like, paranormal or supernatural. And this has a side of that, to be sure. But, like, usually we cover, like, wolfmen or the Jersey Devil or things like that. We don't usually cover 3 to 6 foot long, wriggling in blood red intestine creatures like this one, living in the sand waste.
You.
Yeah, I know, it's gross.
I want to wash my hands now.
But that's exactly what we're looking at today, is a creature that has been reported for close to a century now, or at least reported by Westerners or in conjunction with Westerners visiting foreign lands for close to a century now, and theoretically going back a very, very long time. We are indeed talking about one of the most interesting legends of cryptozoology, the Ulgoy Korkoy, also known,
bless you,
thank you, as the Mongolian death worm. I don't know. That's how I feel like it moves through the sand.
Ooh.
Ooh.
I was picturing what I was... I feel like it's more like a tunneling sound, but okay.
Well,
like it's like a sifting sound. Yours was like hard earth kind of tunneling.
Yeah, that's true.
That's what it felt like.
That's true.
So, Sam.
Yes.
Right off the bat, when we think Mongolian death worm, I think of a giant desert worm.
Yeah, you're probably thinking...
Are we in the right realm?
Like most people, you're probably envisioning something very close to Dune.
What do you possibly
right?
mean?
This is not necessarily Dune, but it is close. It is a desert-dwelling creature. It is larger than any other known quote-unquote worm in the world. And it does...
You sure about that, Sammy boy?
Wow. No, that's your job, because the theoretical, thinking about this thing and learning about this thing, which may or may not be real, grossed me out so much that I could not bear to learn about anything close to it that is actually real.
I learned way too many things about worms. I want to share them all.
All right.
It's gross.
This is really just an episode on the biology of the worm. Anyway, so the Ulgoy Korkoy. Let's see how many different ways I pronounce that during the next course of this episode. It is Mongolian for long intestine worm, which, like I said, is a massive worm. Theoretically, your reports are going to vary from like 1.5 foot to 6 foot, but in any case, a lot bigger and with a lot more girth than your normal worm has.
Again, thick boy.
Thick boy. It's the thickest worm. Now, it spends the majority of its time rooting around underneath the sands of the Gobi Desert in Mongolia. And our very first description of this worm comes from a book called On the Trail of Ancient Man by a fellow named Roy Chapman Andrews. I don't know why I'm affecting a British accent, because he is undoubtedly American.
Whoa.
He's the most American.
That was a twist. Because we say Roy Chapman Andrews like that.
Usually,
I think a sir.
Yeah, usually people with three names are British. That's just
or
how it
serial
works.
Killers. Or no, it's just assassins.
Yeah. Assassin. Now the actual story of the death worm, like I mentioned, potentially stretches far back to time immemorial. However, it is fair to say that Andrews, as far as we can tell, is the first individual who documented it in the English language, at least. Now, unlike the majority of people who find themselves mixed up in this big, beautiful thing that we call cryptozoology, my arms were just out.
Yeah,
I was reaching for the skies. Roy Chapman Andrews was by no means a kooky guy. I mean, I hate to say it. A lot of my friends are cryptozoologists. Okay, I have nothing but love for them. I think of myself as like half cryptozoologist. But y'all can be kooky sometimes, you know, and that's okay. Roy Chapman Andrews was not that. He was a very amazing individual. He was very eccentric. He was very just bad to the bone. He is often cited as one of, if not the principal inspiration for the character of Indiana Jones, who I think is a favorite of both of us. Do you love Indy?
Love Indy.
I love Indy, man. He's, yeah, man.
I love him for the same reasons why I like Professor Grant from the Jurassic Park movies.
Why?
Because he finds old stuff and takes it.
No, he doesn't. That belongs in a museum is like his catchphrase.
Yeah, but he took it out of its native
time and place. That makes sense. Okay, that makes sense. His biography is titled Dragon Hunter. So that's pretty much all. All right, never mind.
This guy's pretty metal.
Yeah, exactly.
I dig it.
He's fantastic. He began his career in archaeology and exploration as the custodian of the American Museum of Natural History in 1906 at age 22. In 1934, he ascended to the rank of the director of the Museum of American, or the director of the American Museum of Natural History.
Whoa.
Yeah.
What did he have? Did he like challenge the former one to a duel
yes,
or something and win?
And he killed him.
I am the captain now.
It really wouldn't surprise me with how much of a badass this guy is if that was what happened. But instead, and he could have done it that way.
Yeah, that could have been.
That would have been legally binding. But he decided to do the honorable thing and work
just
for it.
Take his job the old fashioned way.
Yeah. The slow ascent of the corporate ladder. Now, the intervening years were packed to the brim with adventures. He started by researching whales, having been sent to retrieve the skeleton of a beached whale from Long Island, and he traveled the world to Alaska, Indonesia, China, Japan, and Korea, collecting specimens of all sorts of marine mammals. Recounting these times, he said fondly, quote, "In my first 15 years of fieldwork, I can remember just 10 times when I had really narrow escapes from death. Two were from drowning in typhoons. One was when our boat was charged by a wounded whale. Once my wife and I were nearly eaten by wild dogs. Once we were in great danger from fanatical llama priests. Two were
wait,
close."
Wait.
Not llama like
okay.
Llama. No.
I immediately thought of like Emperor's New Groove style llama lords.
LAMA. I don't know the exact definition of that. An honorific title applied to a spiritual leader in Tibetan Buddhism.
That makes
sense. So, yeah. I'm going to go back into my.
Wait. I thought they were pretty like calm folks.
You'd think.
Yeah.
Yeah. Once we were in danger from fanatical llama priests, who we now know means Buddhist priests. Two were close calls when I fell over a cliff. Once was nearly caught by a huge python, and twice I might have been killed by bandits. Now, what I really like, unquote, what I really like about that is he says, I might have been killed by bandits.
He's
as
not
if
sure.
He's not sure.
They might have,
maybe
go,
I didn't.
Like they did.
Because my current life is living the dream. It's too good to be reality.
So wait, I'm confused.
Those bandits must have killed me.
Where's our worm creature?
We're getting
we're
there.
We're just talking about
we're
Mr.
getting
Chapman.
There. I want to talk about everyone involved in this story
this
because
wild.
It's beautiful. However, while the sea and the things within it that scared and intrigued him were his first academic and scholarly loves, after a decade and a half, he decided it was time to pursue the true desire of his heart, figuring out where humans came from and why.
Oh boy.
Yes.
Where'd he go?
Andrews was convinced that humanity had emerged from Central Asia. And so, with that in mind, he set out for the Gobi Desert in 1922.
That's interesting.
You want to talk about
out of Africa
theory and all that?
No, I just want to talk about the Fertile Crescent for a moment.
Please.
So,
I'll drink my coffee. You give us a history lesson of Mesopotamia.
I'm just going to breeze over the basic stuff. It's interesting that he thinks that is the centralized location for humans, probably mainly because of the Fertile Crescent, where we have the first real signs of civilization.
Gilgamesh.
Sure. I think it's really odd that he assumes that we came out of the Gobi Desert first. That's a strange place to start. But I can kind of see where that line of thinking was at for Central Asia. It doesn't, I mean, of course, now we know a lot better than that. But it's interesting to see like these outdated concepts and where they were at that point in time. I just thought it was interesting.
I love that. It's
a weird place. Anyway, he goes to the desert.
He goes to the desert.
Enlightenment.
In search. Well, yeah, it's like kind of it's not stereotypical. It's kind of archetypal. And what he discovers is enlightenment, in a sense. It's not necessarily what he was looking for, but instead it was something even more ancient. It was a boatload of dinosaurs.
No.
Yes.
He is Professor Grant.
I know. He just stumbled upon them.
I mean, it makes sense. There's nothing else out there in the desert.
Yeah. He was able to find the complete skeletons of smaller dinosaurs as well as portions of larger beasts. Now, he was the first man to discover dinosaurs in northern Asia, and he also amassed the largest collection of mammals to come from Central Asia, cataloging more than just a few new species and shipping them back home. Now, in 1923, he returned to the Gobi, where he discovered the oldest mammal bones ever, and I think that record still stands, as well as the first ever batch of dinosaur eggs. It's very interesting because before this, scientists were like, we think they laid eggs, but who knows? Now they knew for sure. So.
Oh, early 20th century science.
Yeah.
Dinosaurs. Oh, boy.
However, just like I wrote Indiana Jones. I don't know why I said that.
Because that's who he reminds you of.
Yeah. Just like Arthur Conan Doyle, these eggs, which had at one point been Andrew's crowning joy, soon turned into an object of irritation when the public refused to give any attention to any of his other brilliant works. I hate Sherlock Holmes. I'm going to kill him.
Well, I mean, that makes sense, though.
Oh, it totally makes sense.
Like, you finally have found the evidence to confirm something.
Yeah.
That has been speculative since then.
Yeah.
Yeah, of course it makes sense that that's what your crowning achievement would be.
And it also makes sense to be like, guys, I do other things.
Yeah.
Especially with him, because, like, of course.
Hey, how big were the dinosaur eggs, sir?
I do other things. Because that.
So are the size of my fist. Larger my head.
Because he wasn't there to discover dinosaurs. You know, he was there to look for prehistoric man. And so it makes sense that, like, he gets pissed that that's all he ever is to people.
Yeah.
But on my side of things, it's like, just be happy that people love you and you're probably pretty well off at this point. Your entire life is just adventures. Like, what the hell? Speaking of adventures.
Could you imagine if he lived now? His YouTube channel would be insane.
It'd be wild. I know. That would be so cool. I don't want to sound like a true millennial, but if, like, historical people had YouTubes, that'd be so dope. Like Joan of Arc's YouTube channel. That'd be amazing.
It's literally just stuff to make people riot.
So, speaking of adventures and lots of money, he ended up selling one of the eggs. So that's really interesting.
About. Good old 20th century archaeology,
exactly,
and paleontology. You find it, you keep it,
you sell it
later for profit.
Well, he literally found 24 of them, and so he was like,
I could do without one.
Yeah, the quote is like, well, we had 24 eggs, so why did we need another one? And so he sold it for what today would be $70,000.
Oh, man, you got to go higher, man.
I know. It
you
kind of surprised
that. Me. 70,000?
Yeah. Well, it was 5,000 in the day, and then I converted that over. And it's 70,000
for inflation. Whatnot? Wow, yeah. That's some weak sauce, right there.
Yeah, I know. It seemed strangely affordable.
So I wonder if that 1 out of 24, if that was one clutch of eggs, or if that was, like a nesting area. That'd be interesting. We don't know what the dinosaur was, right?
Oh, I don't know what dinosaur it was.
That's fine.
He sold one. It was like one egg. There's a picture of him. And the guy who bought the egg,
it just is
just holding it up.
Super
He's
stoked.
Like, look at this freaking egg I bought, guys. And it is. It's like, oh, to be at that point in human history.
It belongs in a museum.
Nice. Now,
because if it was like all in the same clutch, you'd probably want to keep the set together. But whatever.
Nah. He doesn't care.
Yeah. Anyway, what else does he find out in the desert?
Andrews loved the Gobi, and he believed that it held a multitude of undiscovered secrets. However, in the 1930s, he was forced to say goodbye to the region for the rest of his life due to the political turmoil of the area, which will that'll actually come in a little later. Now, he went on to write 23 books about his adventures and findings, and he named his horse Kubla Khan, which I love. However, while his entire life is of interest, and we just barely scratched the surface of it, his relevance to our episode today, this is like my philosophy of this episode, is that people are going into the Gobi to like find this beast. And so I figured it'd be fun to like go on a journey as well and like talk about all these people and like give all this detail. Some people might think it's superfluous. I don't care. Anyway, so here we finally are. 20 minutes in to the first mention of the Mongolian death worm.
Oh, yeah, that's what we're talking about.
Yeah, that's what we're talking about. Shortly after being awarded his permits to explore the Gobi, Andrews was summoned before the Mongolian premier, where he had a most unusual request made of him. Quote, the premier asked that if it were possible, I should capture for the Mongolian government a specimen of the Ugoi Quarkoi. It is shaped like a sausage, 2 feet long, has neither head nor legs, and is so poisonous that merely to touch it means instant death. It lives in the most desolate parts of the Gobi Desert, whither we are going. For the Mongols, it seems to be what the dragon is for the Chinese. The premier said that although he had never seen it himself, he knew a man who had, and had lived to tell the tale. I promised to produce the Ugoi Quarkoi, if we had chance to cross its path, and explain how it could be seized, unquote. Now, later on in his life, writing in a volume called The New Conquest of Central Asia, Andrews stated that he believed the Mongolian death worm to be a mostly mythical animal. However, it may have had some sort of basis in fact, for, quote, every northern Mongol firmly believes in it and will give essentially the same description, unquote. He believed that there had to be some sort of creature, most likely a reptile, that inspired the myth and wished future explorers luck in finding it. So, we can see that this is not some sort of modern invention. It's not some people, like, coming across. This is what often happens, I feel like, in cryptozoology. Oh, let's look at these ship logs from 1500. Oh, they saw mermaids. Let's go find the mermaids. Like, you have the premier of Mongolia, basically the prime minister, being like, can you find me this worm, sir? So you do have this idea that it is a...
I feel like it was more like, can I find you this worm, sir?
Well, you have this idea that it's a very real thing to these people, and that just comes through in every single account of individuals interacting with Mongolian people in the Gobi Desert. All of them are convinced of this thing. But what's interesting is the majority of it is secondhand. You don't really find a lot of people who have a firsthand eyewitness account. And that's going to go one of two ways. Of course, the rational way is to say, well, it's just hearsay, and they're hearing stories, and they're telling stories, and this and that. The other way, my way, is that this thing kills almost everyone it comes in contact with.
So who lives to tell the tale?
Some people. Not a lot.
Okay.
Some people. We'll talk about them in a second. Unfortunately, most of them are nameless, but that's fine. Now, it wasn't just Americans entering the Gobi to do research that found themselves butting up against the legend of the Ugoi Quarkoi. The USSR's Academy of the Sciences began exploring the Gobi in 1946 under the direction of a Dr. Yuri Orlov. So the reason that Chapman was unable to return to the Gobi to finish his work is that sometime, I want to say it's like 1928. Yeah, so Mongolia became the second state to formally install a Marxist regime, and it was the first satellite state of the USSR. So because you could not enter the, even before that communist regime, you could not enter the Gobi, especially for like scientific expeditions, without the blessing and permit of the government. Now it was just shut down to pretty much everybody who wasn't a communist. So, and that's where the Soviets come in. our good friends. No. Now, Dr. Orlov, he was also quite the character. Whereas Andrews held mastery over the natural and archaeological realms, Orlov was a master of physical sciences. He currently serves as the professor of physics emeritus at Cornell. In the 70s, he was imprisoned for political dissidence. He was exiled after 9 years in prison. He splits his time between the study of physics and the relentless crusading of human rights. So he's really quite an interesting person all by himself.
Yeah, sounds like it.
And he led this research expedition into the Gobi, which was documented by a Russian paleontologist by the name of Ivan Antonovich Efremov. Efremov. And this book is called Doroga Vetrov, or The Wind's Path. Now, one of his subordinates, a young man named Dan Zhang, who was accompanying the expedition as a geologist, also served as a translator. And Dan Zhang was told to speak with an old man by the name of Sveng. Oh, man.
That was impressive.
Thanks, Sveng.
I read that and I was like, tis even Gigi.
Yeah, I think it's Sveng. Okay. And that's what I'm going to call him. Now, the subject of the death worm reared its ugly worm head not long after the conversation started.
Or was it its tail? Who knows?
Who knows? That is another part of it. You cannot distinguish the face from the tail, which really sucks. It really sucks. Now, while Sveng told him that he had never seen the beast himself, he had heard much about it, and even was known and even knew which areas in the desert it was supposed to reside. However, those areas were about 80 miles southwest or southeast of where they were at the time. Now, the worm was able to kill with one movement of its body, and this was very notorious. Now, the young geologist Dan Zhang, he related this information to his superiors, chuckling at the old man's superstitious words as he did, and greatly offending him. Sveng, let loose a barrage of angry words and stormed off, and the expedition knew in that moment that they had seriously underestimated the importance of what they had previously assumed to be just another old wives' tale of the desert. Now, after this, Efremov, the author of the book, tries to lend the story some credence, postulating that the animal might be some kind of prehistoric monster that has survived through the ages by burrowing under desert sand. I don't know. You're the paleontologist here. It kind of works, right?
I mean, I think the question is simply, like, has the climate stayed relatively the same for the last 65 million years there? And it's probably not.
Hmm.
For several different things, we've had multiple ice ages since dinosaurs were around. So the Gobi Desert's tough in general because, one, like, just like every desert, there's a lot of, like, heat changes.
Mm.
The Gobi Desert is no different from that. In fact, I think it's kind of scarier than even someplace like Death Valley back in California, where temperatures get, like, 120 and up. The Gobi Desert has temperature swings of, like, 100 degrees in a day.
Yeah.
Where at night it drops to, like, below 40
degrees
Celsius. Like it's cold. And I mean, like, negative 40.
Yeah. That sucks.
And in the daytime, in winter, it can get to, like, 83 degrees, which is pleasant.
Sure.
But freezing cold at night. And then the Gobi Desert also doesn't have water, mainly because all the moisture that would have creeped up to it is from the Indian Ocean. And, well, what do you have right below the Gobi Desert?
I want to guess. The Himalayas.
The Himalayas.
Yay, I did it.
Which basically squeezes all the moisture out of the atmosphere before it can get to the Gobi Desert. So it's incredibly cold and hot and just grossly inhospitable to everything. So is it out of the realm of existence? No. Is it, and I'll get more into the environment of the Gobi Desert later, but it's probably not.
Okay.
Everything evolves. It's definitely not going to be a living fossil of a species. It's not going to be unchanged and untouched by the world since then.
And that is exactly the term that Efremov uses, that he thinks that it is a living fossil. So,
probably
good
not.
To know.
Even the, we found one.
Coelacanth.
Yeah, even the coelacanth the current living day coelacanths are slightly different than the prehistoric fossils that we have found before.
This just makes me want to watch Planet Earth.
Do it.
All right. Yeah, we'll talk more about the Gobi as a setting a little bit later on with your major contribution. So now the creature, which may or may not have been a living fossil in that case, it has a tendency to surface only in the months of June and July, according to the people in Efremov's report, who were speaking through translators and all of that, so who knows for sure. Their expedition revealed no evidence living or dead of the worm. However, A, that's not really what they were there to do anyway, much as is often the case until the 1990s, the Ogokokori is a afterthought of expeditions. You don't really go on an expedition to find one itself. But there is also quite the twist to this particular chapter in the Deathworm saga. See, after he went on the expedition with Orlov and the others, Efremov became a writer of science fiction stories, writing specifically in a 1954 collection a story called Ulgoy Korkoy, which was published 4 years after his account, it was published 4 years after the expedition and 4 years before his account of the expedition came out. Now, in addition to the details he had gathered on his journey, Efremov blended elements of lore that have now become inseparable to the mythos of the Death Worm. One of the main aspects that elevates the Death Worm above just a bizarre wriggling oddity in the desert and into the realm of the supernatural is its ability to kill at a distance. As opposed to being torn apart by vicious fangs or constricted to the point of internal hemorrhage, the worm, according to cryptozoologists around the world, but especially one by the name of Ivan Makkerli, who we're going to talk about in depth here in a moment, has the ability to electrocute its victims without needing to touch them. Now, the story itself also included a unique aspect, something which has not been talked about widely, has never come up in another report, and so we have a good idea that even if the worm itself is a mythological or fictitious creature, that this specific element is something that was entirely invented by Efremov, which is that right before the worm electrocutes its victims, it writhes and turns a dark purple color with blue highlights shooting throughout its body. Now, while the entire...
So it charges up like Godzilla.
Pretty much, yeah. Oh, God, that movie. I love that movie so much.
I'm stoked for the next one.
Oh, yeah, dude. It's going to be so good. Now, it is not until after the first couple of decades of research into the beast that eyewitness reports begin to be documented. Even the native Mongolian guides usually passed information to others rather than talking about seeing it themselves. And one of the most important eyewitness reports comes from 1987. Now, that witness was a Mongolian author by the name of...
You can do it.
Dongdog Jin Vegmed. Sure. And he records his sighting in the book Altaj Tzakta Guvd. That's probably all wrong. Now, he claimed to be traveling through the Gobi on camelback around the Tost Mountains in the southern part of the country when he was beset by some sort of subterranean creature he believed to either be the Death Worm itself or else its very close relative, another cryptid.
What?
Yep, which is called the Shar Korkoy, or the Yellow Worm. Yeah, that's what's kind of cool here. You have multiple varieties of this cryptid, none of which are proved to be real.
Perfect.
So you've got that going for you. Now, while not much detail was either recorded or translated, one important aspect of the account was the realization that the worm could be identified moving under the ground because it displaced sand on the surface. Now, similar accounts written by native Mongolians or others visiting the region have contributed much to the lore of this devilish creature, including its ability to spit extremely toxic venom, adding another weapon to its ranged attack arsenal. However, one of the most important events in the modern history of the worm and its mythos was the expedition of the previously mentioned cryptozoologist extraordinaire, Ivan Makkerli. Now, Mackerly was a Czech cryptozoologist who spent the majority of his life in pursuit of the strange, 40 years traveling the world, looking for some of the big-name cryptids like the Loch Ness Monster, and some others like the elephant birds of Madagascar, which were wiped out by humans around the 12th century, although Mackerly and others believe that a remnant has survived to this day. Now, almost all of the information that we have about the Death Worm comes through Mackerly. He, like, all of these stories that we've told, with the possible exclusion of that most recent eyewitness report, they all were pretty much lost and forgotten. And Mackerly, having gotten the itch for Worm...
What?
Yeah, having gotten the worm
you
bug.
You read that?
I hate this.
Yeah.
He decided that he was going to find out as much as he can. So that initial encounter, okay, it took place when he was at a party, I guess, and he was talking to a Mongolian student, Mongolian college student, regaling her with tales of his pursuit of the Loch Ness Monster. And
oh boy.
Yeah. And she leans in close and whispers, "We too have a horrible creature living in Mongolia. We call it the Ulgoy Korkoy Monster, and it lives buried in the Gobi Desert sand dunes. It can kill a man, horse, or even a camel." And at that point, he was hooked. Now, from there, that's when he starts to do all of the research that he can. And he uncovers Chapman Andrews' account, and he uncovers Efremov's book, as well as his short story, and he starts to find all of these different sources and brings them together.
Without the use of the internet,
I know, it's insane. I was like sitting here. He wrote a lengthy article for an issue of Fate magazine in like 1996, and I sat on my computer for half an hour trying to like find it. I couldn't find it, and then I gave up. I'd be a terrible researcher. I could never be a cryptozoologist. You have to go do things. Sounds terrible. Now, he began to ask every Mongolian he knew about the creature, and apparently that was a large number of Mongolian people. However, to his dismay, they always seemed unwilling to talk about it, kind of covering their mouths or only speaking when no one else could hear them. And while he did all of this work in uncovering accounts of the creature, he decided that it was finally time for him to venture into the Gobi himself to try to find it. And when he did, he went all out. So the that communist state, that Marxist state, fell sometime, it's like 90, 92, 93 or something like that.
Okay, early 90s.
Yeah, so he was pretty much, as soon as that happened, he was in. He was like, all right, I'm going to go find this worm. Now, lore... and by lore, I do literally mean the book Dune tells us that worms in the sand can be brought to the surface by sensing vibrations. They sense vibrations. They come up. It's not necessarily impossible. It's fine. And so he builds like this mechanized thumping machine that they just take all over the desert. Thump, 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 thump. They also get explosive charges and bury them in the sand and then just try to blow the thing out. That doesn't work, unfortunately.
You don't say.
I don't say.
Crazy.
Now, he also partnered with locals quite intimately, from guides finding their way around the Gobi to the nomads and herdsmen who spent their entire lives in the desert. And then and there, under the influence of some relatively good Mongolian vodka, they were able to extract some more information about these creatures that the individuals seemed fearful to even mention by name. Now, some of this new information that came to light was that the acid spat by the creature had the ability to corrode pretty much any material almost instantly, as well as turn it yellow. Its victims were always, if they were killed by the acid and not the electrocution, they would have like holes kind of burnt into them, and the holes would have a yellowish tinge Now, the color yellow was also said to attract the creature, with Mongolians telling stories of children dressed in yellow or with yellow toys, or even, specifically in one case, a young child who kept his toys in a yellow box, and he opened up to grab one of the toys, and of course, inside was the death worm, and he touched it, and he died, and then the worm slithered away, and then the parents came, and they were like, our son has been killed by the Ulgoi Korkoi, and look, there is its trail slithering away through the desert, and so they went after it to try to get revenge, and they died. And that's where my theory that the reason we don't have a lot of eyewitness reports is because everyone keeps dying. But who knows? I don't know. Ivan also got clues about the way the worm operates and becomes so very, very poisonous. Now, when the worm wants to attack something using poison at a distance, it pokes about half of its body up out of the sand. This is the point where I really started to have to fight my gag reflex out of the sand, and then it begins to swell like a blood-filled intestine, just swelling and swelling until it gets to the point where it looks as though it is about to burst. And finally, when it does, it lets out a stream of incredibly deadly poison, or acid, or poisonous acid, it's not really clear, that can travel a few yards and again corrode everything it comes in contact with. Losing hair sucks. Most people don't realize how much they care about their hair until they notice they have started losing it. And that's why we at Not Alone recommend Keeps. Keeps is the easiest and most affordable way to keep the hair you have. Now, these FDA-approved products, which used to cost so much, are finally, through Keeps, inexpensive and easy to get. For 5 minutes now and just $1 a day, you'll never have to worry about hair loss again, because getting started with Keeps is so easy that sign-up takes less than 5 minutes. All you have to do is answer a few questions and snap some photos of your hair. At that point, a licensed physician will review your information online and recommend the right treatment for you. Then, it's shipped right to your door every 3 months. Now, Keeps offers generic versions of the only two FDA-approved hair loss products out there. Some of you have probably even tried them before, but you've never gotten them for this low of a price. Keeps is available for as low as $10 a month. Plus, now, you can get your first month for free. Now, that's one heck of a deal for getting to keep your hair. Now, to receive your first month of treatment for free, go to keeps.com/alone. That's KEEPS.com/ALONE. That's a free month of treatment at keeps.com/alone. Keeps. Hair today, hair tomorrow. Another sign that you may be near the dwelling place of the Ulgoi Korkoi is the presence of the black saxaul shrub. I think that's how you say that. S-A-X-A-U-L, shrub. Now, in the Gobi, the saxaul shrub is the closest thing to a tree there is, either to provide shelter or firewood for nomads. Now, the roots of the tree often end up being parasitized by a cigar-shaped plant called the goyo, which can be, theoretically, extremely poisonous. Now, this sort of acquired toxicity can also be seen in other species of animals, right? The idea is that the worm eats the goyo plant, the plant is toxic, it spits that toxin out. This also happens with the South American poison dart frog. Now, in that case, the frogs do not spit their poison, they secrete it through their skin, which would also kind of stay in line with the legend of the creature that's so deadly that to touch it is certain death. The dart, in the name of the dart frog, indicates their use in creating a poison for the indigenous people's blow darts themselves. They also wrestle for territory because they're luchadors, and I love them.
The poison dart frogs?
Yes.
That's great.
They're pretty cool. Now, it should be noted that the theoretically toxic materials in question are unknown whether or not to be actually poisonous, with some species of goyo at least being confirmed safe to eat. Now, it was also through Mackerly's investigation that secondhand confirmation of the worm's capability to kill via electric shock was obtained. Again, you have this detail cropping up in Efremov's short story about it, but he doesn't even necessarily mention it in his actual account of talking with people. What the guide tells him is that years ago, on an unconnected expedition, a geologist had fallen dead with absolutely no indication after poking holes in the sand with a metal rod, which is something that I can get behind, you know?
To poke
holes
in the sand with a metal rod?
Do you ever just find something like a stick or a rod and you're like, this is mine now. I am using this. It is my guide through life. And then you just go around hitting things with it.
Like every young man.
Yeah, exactly. I had a dream the other night. There's like this tree limb out there that's been down for like 3 weeks now.
Oh no.
And I had a dream about taking it, and I put it on my porch until such a time as I moved. And then I took it with me when I moved, and then I got woodworking equipment and I made a beautiful staff out of it. It was quite good.
Glorious.
I wonder what Freud would say about that one. Who knows? Anyway, yeah, so he's like poking his iron rod in the sand, and suddenly he falls dead because he had poked a worm, and the worm had electrocuted him. And they knew this because as they approached, as their feet were pounding on the sand, the worm came up, and they bravely left their friend for dead and ran away.
Oh, man.
Yeah. Now, as we mentioned before, the Mongolians were reticent to even talk about the worms, and the nomads could only be persuaded to do so after multiple bottles of vodka. Now, Mackerly soon came to understand that just speaking the name of the Ulgoy Khorkhoy was to invite disaster on yourself and your home, although not for the typical reasons one may think. Like we mentioned, Mongolia was the second country in the world to become a communist state, the first satellite of Soviet Russia. Now, as often happens with these sorts of regimes, certain aspects of native culture of a place or people find themselves either de-emphasized or completely erased. Such tales of terrifying desert monsters were definitely on that list of prohibited subjects. However, even after the fall of the communist state, the local people sometimes had difficulty speaking about these subjects that had previously been prohibited. Like Genghis Khan. I mean, like, they weren't even allowed to talk about Genghis Khan. And he's the Genghis, that guy.
New leadership, you know?
Yeah.
It's wild. Erase the old ones.
Yeah, it's wild.
From 800 years ago.
Real big threat there. Now, it was through Mackerly as well, however, that some of the most superstitious or even paranormal sides of the worm came out. Like we mentioned at the beginning of this, the worm is interesting because it does denote just another creature, just something out in the wilderness that has not been discovered yet, but has the ability or theoretically could be discovered. It is not inherently supernatural or paranormal, but when you have such elusive creatures and mysterious abilities, these things sort of just naturally get attached to it. So the idea of bad fortune befalling the speakers of its name is not just a politically or socially motivated idea. It also has some of that inherent bad juju associated with it. And one night, the expedition stayed with a desert shaman. That's how some people say shaman. And it's a really interesting pronunciation of the word. I just tried it out just to see. I don't like it. I'm going to say shaman. Now, he told them that they needed to leave this place and abandon their goal. Because the Ulgoy Khorkhoy was the demon of the desert. A being of pure evil, animated by evil forces and ancient magics. The intestine worm, like we mentioned, its name means, was no natural worm at all, but was, and this is the point where I almost threw up, a real, disembodied, wriggling, blood-filled intestine polluted by evil to make its blood poisonous to those who come in contact with it.
That's gross.
The worst.
That's just nasty.
Yeah. Now, the worst, the very worst of it, is almost right here. That night, Mackerly had a nightmare of being trapped on a great purple sand dune, hunted by some horrible, faceless creature. And when he woke, it was due to an unbearable pain in his back where, in the dream, the creature had latched onto him like a leech. Now, the expedition's doctor came to him and found not only a preponderance of bruises on his previously undamaged body, but also a long pouch filled with blood on his back, which had formed in the night and was fit to burst.
Ew.
Yeah. Over the next few days, more pouches of blood, or hematoma, began to appear all over his body, and the expedition doctor told him he was in real risk of heart failure. The expedition was aborted, and Ivan was rushed to the hospital. And what I want to end with here, because that's the end of his story.
Ew,
he died.
That's gross.
Yep, it's bad. He died a little bit, like 10, 15 years later or something like that. Yeah.
I thought you were like, he died a little bit later in the hospital.
Yeah, no, I should clarify. Not that close to the time, but close enough. And when he left the expedition, looking back on it, this is what he has to say. It's a lengthy quote, but I want to read it because he seemed like he was quite the writer, and he wrote a lot of books and stuff. So I'm just going to read it out.
So other people agree with you.
Yeah. The free market agrees with me. And then Jason is going to give us some more of that good science. All right. Quote, "Could it really be a curse? Nonsense, surely, but there could be a certain explanation. What if the creature is really an immaterial apparition? When a person stays in the desert, where it seems only the shape of the dunes change, where there is sand and only sand, and that person can fall into a sort of hypnotized state. Images and odd visions can seep into their mind, either from their subconscious, or they are mentally forwarded by a shaman or lama. Or are we dealing with beings from a world of different dimensions? One theory states that apparitions are closely linked to certain places. Our planet is laced with ley lines. They are imaginary lines that correspond to underground currents of an unknown earthly force. Very sensitive people, such as dowsers, are aware of the force. It is said that on ley line crossings where the energy is concentrated most powerfully, some kind of bridges can be created from time to time. These bridges unite our world with other invisible worlds or realms of being that run parallel with our own. Some people believe that these specific spots are closely linked to paranormal phenomena, as are apparitions of ghosts, raging poltergeists, and even UFOs. A less frightening and more down-to-earth possibility is that the Ogoi Korkoi is in the end a living animal, but so rare that shamans have for ages worshipped it as a deity. They might still be bent on magical ritual, sending out negative forces by telepathy onto anyone who attempts to disrupt the Ogoi Korkoi's peace by trespassing onto the sacred dunes. Is the animal protected by a sorcerer's curse like the mummified pharaohs were by the Egyptian priests? Scientists disregard the curse possibility, but if we have a bit of faith in so-called healers, people who have the ability to heal from a distance, why could there not exist a shaman with the power to do the opposite and to make his victims ill?" Unquote. Now that's a pretty loaded statement. I'd like to point out that he makes some pretty big assumptions there.
You don't say.
I really like the part when he's like, if we have faith in so-called healers, people who have the ability to heal at a distance.
Who's we?
Yeah. I don't necessarily have that belief, Mr. Mackerly. But it is worth noted that, like, he comes from a different area of the world and an older area of the world that has a more superstitious or at least more superstitious elements in their culture, as well as pretty much everywhere other than America does, I would say, because we're the young hip brother who thinks it's stupid to believe in anything. So,
well, we've only been around for 300 years.
Not even. We'll see if we get there. It's actually my dream to live to the tricentennial. Ever since I was a kid, I was like, I just want to live to 2077 or 2076. And guess what? I'm not going to do it if I keep eating pasta 5 days a week.
Truth.
So I'm gonna make some life changes, but while I contemplate how to do that better, Jason, Why don't you break it down? What do you think you found?
Okay, so worms, right? They're crazy.
Worms make dirt.
You're sort of wrong.
Well, that's not a song by the Aquabats, I'm sorry.
So worms are weird. Very, very strange. So I want to break down this strange worm piece by piece. So originally it said it can get up to like 6 feet in length. Most of the time, most cases though, somewhere around 2 feet, right?
2 to 3 is the accepted norm. Sausage shaped.
Yes. Well, I was like, okay. The biggest worm I know is an earthworm, and those are small. Like,
yeah.
What, like 8 inches maximum, maybe?
Oh, that would
maybe
be a
that's
wild
a big worm, right?
That would ruin my life. Oh, no.
Here we go.
Oh, no.
There is an African species of earthworm. I did not find any pictures of it. That can get up to 22 feet in length.
No, you can't. No, they can't. No.
I have no idea how true that is. I found it on the internet, so everyone take that with a grain of salt. But that is a earthworm and lives the same exact way of earthworms that we have here in the States, which is essentially eating more decomposing organic material and then pooping it out into dirt.
Worms
yeah.
make dirt.
Like you said.
Thank you, Aquabats.
Now, here's the thing about worms, though. They're incredibly simple, and all land-based worms don't have venom or poison or electricity.
Okay.
So
what's your point?
We have to go under the sea for.
Under the sea. Okay.
But before we get there, earthworms typically inhabit more like normal climates. We're not talking about extreme climates like a desert. We're talking about tropical and temperate areas like we have, again, here in the States, where vegetation is lush, so they actually have a food source to eat. That becomes an issue when we go out to the desert. And also would make kind of a bit of sense because anything that would be living would be somewhere around that shrubbery. What?
Why do worms come up when it rains?
They're the most active when it's raining.
Why?
I didn't look anything up farther than that.
That's okay. That was a random worm question.
No, that's a good one. They're active during the rain. I'm assuming it's because
they're thirsty.
They're getting back to their home roots of the water.
Okay.
Otherwise, besides for leeches that live in ponds and streams and other fun stuff, which
are they
also worms?
Oh,
yes,
no.
They are.
Oh, God, no.
Worms. Have fun with that now. Otherwise, the other issue, is that the Mongolian death worm is really like an amalgamation of a bunch of different things. There is one worm that does spray things. And unfortunately, it's a tree-dwelling worm species.
Worms in the trees?
Yes.
Why?
And it does not move quickly either. This species of worm, called the velvet worm, shoots mucus from two... It's basically like a blastoise. It has two protrusions that are kind of cannon-like shaped that shoot mucus from its almost facial area... To trap, it's a sticky mucus, yes.
I have a
to
lot
trap
of...
trap prey.
I have some questions that I don't really want answers to.
Go for it.
How big is this worm?
It's not very big.
Okay.
It's small.
Does it fall out of trees onto people?
Probably not.
Okay, thank
it
God.
It seems to be a good climber.
Where is this at?
It is, I think, Amazonian.
Okay, good. I'll never go there. Go ahead.
Anyway, so it does trap its prey, which tend to be... other insects for the most part, in this thick mucus that's sticky, and basically it sounds like a horrible way to die because it's a worm and it travels slowly, which means it also eats slowly. So as you're there trapped under this sticky mucus, you are slowly getting eaten alive by a worm.
And you see it. You see it coming at you.
Yes.
And there's nothing you can do.
If you're a bug. This is true. Otherwise... other fun worms, there is one that actually sticks out of the sand, protruding its head and basically its giant mandibles. This one, though, is underwater. So, Sam, you're perfectly fine.
I will
but
never go to the water.
Venomous, which is wonderful.
All right.
Similar to how the Mongolian death worm sticks its upper body out of the sand and boils up with blood to shoot, this one does also ambush predators. Or ambush its prey, which can also be quite larger than itself. In fact, it's been known to chomp fish in half with its powerful mandibles.
Hmm.
It's called the Boppet? The Boppet worm.
No.
Yes.
No.
It's like Hobbit.
Not the Boppet.
The Boppet worm. Also, very pretty, which is scary.
All right.
But one thing that I have noticed is that a lot of art, artistic like interpretations of not only like the death worms from Dune, but the now the Mongolian death worm, is that a lot of them have sort of these tentacle like face whisker adaptations to some of the, and I think that is actually inspired by more of these underwater marine worms than what the current worms that we have in the ground today. But of course, mucus is not poison or venom, which tend to actually form from the cool thing about venom is that it's really just an adaptation of saliva.
Okay.
In order to make it so that you can prey easily. Just like spitting mucus. Because the worms are slow, they have to have some other way in order to
ranged attack,
slow down, or really just kind of deal a lethal blow to anything. That's how spiders also do their trick. Actually, spiders, the reason why they're
let's not.
Is because the venom itself helps break down the organic material inside their prey because they slurp everything up. They always drink, they always eat soup. But other animals typically have venom glands, mainly to help with hunting. A lot of slow-moving animals do this. One that kind of comes to mind for me is the Gila monster, which, are you familiar with that lizard?
I know of it.
Yeah, it's this big, it's also a thick boy.
I've heard of it.
It's a big, big, chunky lizard that actually doesn't get too big. It's like 22 inches max. But it also has venom. Weirdly enough, the opposite of snakes, where venom is coming from their top jaws, they actually have venom that comes out from their lower jaws. And they actually have been observed to flip themselves over while biting prey items to help for gravity to inject.
Now,
the
how
venom,
does
which
how
is cool.
how on God's green earth does evolution correspond to that particular monster? What has to flip itself upside down
see,
to activate its venom?
That's the great thing about evolution, is that it's not perfect.
That's true.
It All screws right. up frequently. Speaking of evolution,
okay,
I think we could probably rule out an actual worm living in the desert. One, it doesn't have nearly the type of environment to support like a big earthworm that just happens to be venomous.
Okay.
Two, there just isn't any worms really in that area to begin with.
Okay. So you don't think it's a worm?
I don't think it's a worm.
So what do you think it is?
Some cryptozoologists think it might be a reptile.
Ooh, okay.
A type of reptile I didn't hear about until about a week ago, which is a worm lizard.
Okay.
Yes, not a snake. A worm lizard, which
what?
Also burrows.
What does... what?
So a worm lizard is a type of lizard that there's actually quite a few of them, mostly Central and South American, that do also burrow, and just like snakes, they have lost limbs in the process.
Okay.
Most of them are quite long and quite small species. They don't get very big, but their body length is very, very long and look very worm-like.
Okay.
You can't really tell much of a difference between their head and their rear, the tip of their tail at least. They're very, they look like worms. Their eyes have receded into their bodies to where there is still a layer of scales that is over their eyes. They're still light sensitive, but they're not nearly as good as what a normal lizard would be. There are some species called mole lizards. There's two of them. One is actually Mexican, so not too far away from us, that do still have their forelimbs. And they've basically become very, very shortened, almost paddle-like limbs to help dig. Their typical diet consists of other subterranean bugs and earthworms.
So they are worms that eat worms.
They are worms that eat worms and other things. Now, the cool thing is that they actually have a fairly decent spread across the world. You can find them in North and South America, Africa, and also into Saudi Arabia. That being said, none have been discovered more east than that.
Okay.
That tends to be kind of the limit to their span, which makes a lot of sense because once you get past Saudi Arabia, well, you got a lot of desert and a lot of, well, environments that don't show or don't really have a support network for a larger subterranean predator to prey on worms and grubs and bugs.
Okay.
But what if there was?
Okay.
I mean, that's fair, right? It matches the body. Also, fun note, they move like a worm. Their scales and skin kind of do most of the moving like an accordion.
Is this how you feel when I talk about ghosts?
Probably.
Damn.
They're actually adorable little buggers.
Okay.
But I don't think they're going to be our prime target. Some cryptozoologists think that it's an undiscovered species of worm lizard that's living in the desert. And I mean, it's possible. One nice thing that I do like about it is that with the fact that they travel with kind of wrinkled skin almost, when you think about building up electrical charges, well, that typically just happens when you have two non-polarized surfaces rubbing up against each other. They might be able to build up enough of a static charge in order to actually release it upon touching something else, to where it's a decent enough shock to spook you to, at the very least. But they're not to the level of, say, like an electric eel, which on very, very rare occasions have killed people, but mostly they're there just to stun. Electric eels do actually have cells in their body that hold these charges and produce them. There's one other type of ray that also has glands to help produce electricity as well in order to, again, kind of stun its prey in order to actually bring it on in and eat it. Yes.
Not this question is going to sound like I'm joking, but I'm not.
Electric eel's not an eel. Is that the question?
No. Could we harness these animals to power things?
No.
Even if we had a million of them.
So, Sam.
Okay.
You've seen The Matrix.
I have.
Using organic...
This. And then he holds up the battery.
Using organic animals as a methodology of powering or being a battery for anything is bad and silly. Mainly because skin, flesh...
Skin.
Organic material in general are not good conductors.
Okay.
Which is why things that do use electricity in order to hunt its prey typically live underwater.
Could we take the cells in the beast, what produces the electricity, and like genetically modify them or
probably
something?
Probably not.
That makes electricity?
I don't think it would be. So it's not really making the electricity. Our bodies are making the electricity as it moves.
Okay.
It's just a way of storing it. It's a bad organic battery, really, which is not going to be nearly as good as what we have now.
So we do the same thing. We just don't release it.
Every little move that we make is electrical. We're organic electricity.
I am the master of thunder.
Sort of. But... anyway,
okay, go ahead. Sorry.
So
I didn't mean to derail.
The idea that maybe something builds up electricity is not too far-fetched in my mind. Again, especially when you're talking about surfaces rubbing up against each other, if it's underground, that makes sense. It's dry. I could see where there's some sort of buildup of static charge.
Okay. So for you, that is a possibility.
Shocking you to death? No.
Okay.
Shocking you and startling you from it? Yes.
What if, does the fact that it was like a metal rod, does that do anything for this? Because I
for
know
me,
that
no.
metal it, conducts electricity a lot better.
Yeah, metal does.
Uh-huh.
But again, organic material in general doesn't conduct electricity easily or very well in general.
That makes sense.
So you can't really hold that big of a charge in some sort of organic living body. At least not particularly well to where it's, again, going to kill you.
Okay.
It's not like it's going to get that much amplified by going through a metal rod. That's more like just putting it on a highway.
All right.
Same charge is going to get there. It's just going to get there a lot better.
Wow.
Now.
Okay.
What it probably is.
Okay.
I think there's really two answers to what the death worm is.
Okay.
Physically, it sounds and looks a little bit more like an Indian red boa.
Indian red boa?
Yes.
Okay.
Or also known as a Central Asian boa, I believe.
Okay.
which are a type of sand boa that are reddish in color. And they are almost worm-shaped. They're also kind of thick. They don't have a very tapered tail. And their head is not a big kind of viperish head that we might think of when we think of snakes.
Okay.
And they aren't, they're pretty rare too. We don't actually see too many of them. Or it's a pit viper, which makes more sense.
Okay.
Because it's actually venomous. Because boas, given its name, is a constrictor. It's not venomous. So my assumption really is that people are going out in the desert. They are taking refuge under these shrub-like trees, where also probably a reptile is taking refuge from the hot summer days as well. And things happen to where they just get bit by a venomous snake and it gets chalked up as being the worm.
Okay. That would make sense.
Otherwise, I mean, from the other worms that I've already talked about, if we really wanted to Frankenstein this monster together, it could be possible, but I don't expect it to actually be a real living creature.
All right. All right. That's fair.
Because you've got, and again, like, you've got too many different ways to kill something.
Yeah.
Like, generally speaking, evolution tends to have all its eggs in one basket. If you're going to be shooting mucus as a way to hunt, you're going to be shooting mucus. You're not going to be sending electrical charges.
That makes sense.
It makes a little, it doesn't really make sense to have your body evolve and use its resources to do two totally different things.
Yeah.
In an environment like a desert where you have to be very, very
precise
and conservative your with your body plan.
Okay. All right.
Also, fun fact I learned about earthworms. You ready for this?
No. Go ahead.
You know that band that they tend to have towards the head?
Yeah.
That's actually, once it's developed, a sign of sexual maturity. And that's where they store their eggs. You're welcome, everyone.
I hate worms. Thanks for coloring that.
This is
part.
What I had to deal with for this week.
Yeah. Yeah, that's true. I had to deal with the abstract disgust. You had to deal with the actual disgusting things that happen.
Earthworms, not so scary. Sea worms, watch yourself. That's what it breaks down to.
Okay. Nematodes. I remember that episode of SpongeBob.
Yeah, like SpongeBob actually had a real death worm because there's some scary stuff in the water. Like,
yeah,
whoa.
The ocean will always be scarier than the desert. Always. Always.
Yeah, it's more biodiverse.
Yeah.
Yeah, like, you can't even compare an ocean to a desert, really, when you think about it, because the ocean has, you have so many diversity within it. A desert, for the most part, because there is so many limited resources, you're going to see kind of the same game plan in a lot of different species of animals.
Mm-hmm.
Like, for example, going back to the worm lizard, they probably evolved very similarly to how snakes eventually evolved by being a lizard, going underground, and then reemerging at some point in time and, well, adapting to the new environment around it. What's really interesting that I find is that both species have a collapsed lung. Snakes have one collapsed lung. I want to say it's the left lung. But worm lizards collapse their right lung, the opposite. So that's one way that we know that they do not originate from the same subterranean lizard from eons ago before snakes actually existed. It's a form of convergent evolution that has essentially adapted these creatures very similarly to one another. But they move different. They have different, essentially, like I said, respiratory functions. It's really interesting.
Wow. That's something. Worms, man.
And worm lizards.
And worm lizards. And lerm wizards. Speaking of lerm wizards, the Mongolian death worm is also featured in one of the most, although not explicitly featured, but also featured in one of the most beloved books of fantasy literature of all time, The Hobbit.
What?
Yep.
When?
So, at
what point?
Yeah, after Bilbo is like, I'm not going on any adventure, and the dwarves are like, you're a freaking coward, Bilbo Baggins.
Right?
He comes back, and he says, quote, tell me what you want done, and I will try it. If I have to walk from here to the east of east and fight the wild wereworms of the last desert, unquote. So
that sounds so badass.
It is so. It's because Bilbo.
Wait, wait. Wereworms. As in like...
like werewolf.
So people transform into worms.
Well, that's not necessarily the case. That has a very strange... like were has an interesting etymology, I believe because... and here we go. I'm probably going to say something wrong, and I want you all to correct me on Twitter. I really actually do. We had a fantastic listener. I can't remember who it was. I could go on Twitter and look, but I'm lazy. Who came out with like four or five different things that we messed up last episode. And I actually do enjoy that. I do not want to just wriggle around in my ignorance. So, but anyway, were means man. So you had this old, in Old English, you had this thing called the Were Guild, which was the price that you paid if you ended up killing a man. And then you could pay the Were Guild, and then you wouldn't have to go to jail, or you wouldn't, more specifically, be killed in recompense by the man's family. So when you see were attached to an animal...
it just means man.
Yeah, it can
be. So man worms.
Yeah, man worms. So most likely a worm the size of a man is what that means. Not necessarily some god awful.
That's crazy.
Terrible, although it could be. But in the early drafts of the book, so the book was published in 37, in earlier drafts between 30 and 32, Tolkien specifically associated these wereworms with the Great Desert of Gobi. Which is noted by John D. Ratliff in his book, The History of the Hobbit. So
that's cool.
That is cool. And I'd like to think that Bilbo Baggins probably would have gotten his butt kicked by one of these worms.
I would assume he would have been eaten alive.
Yeah. Yeah.
Or had eggs laid in his entrails, you didn't bring up.
Why would I?
Because it's an important part. That's one other thing that it feels like the death worm kind of takes from other creatures as well.
Yeah.
Is the fact that it supposedly lays its eggs in the intestines of dead animals, large dead animals like camels and horses.
That's why it becomes
blood red.
Oh, wow. I actually didn't come across that.
You didn't?
No.
Oh, okay. I came across it a couple different places.
Wow.
So, yes, apparently it is basically like a maggot almost.
Well, there we go.
Because when they hatch from their eggs, they then eat the corpse.
Yum.
Yeah.
Tasty.
So, I mean, it feels just like an embellishment upon embellishment, which is wonderful.
All right.
But
yeah.
I don't think there's any real credence to the creature.
And I, being the one who did all of the folklore research and none of the science research, I'm going to say that I believe in this creature and that I think it's out there. I'm not going to go find it. I would like to go to Mongolia. Seems like an interesting place to go. I don't know that I'd like to spend a long time in the desert looking for a worm, but...
probably not. Like I said, it gets cold.
Yeah.
And then hot.
And then cold.
And cold.
It sounds terrible.
It sounds like a desert.
But in any case, so you, as always, don't believe it, and I do believe it.
Well, I believe it that it's a part of the folklore and culture.
Well, that's
of
good.
The nomadic people.
There was like another report. I can't remember exactly what it was that I came across. And I came across it and I was like, all right, I'll talk about this after I finish writing about Mackerly. And then I was like, I don't want to write any more about these damn worms. And there was one report of like a group of scientists showing a common, I can't remember what it was. I think it was a sand snake, sand boa or something.
Yep.
Showing it to nomads and being like, yep, that's the Ogoi Korkori. And they were like, yeah, that is. Yep. So that's the other idea, is it's all just mistaken identity.
Yeah, that was the sand boa that I was
talking
about.
Oh, was it?
Yep,
okay.
Same species.
Yeah, so theoretically, and of course, when you have so many secondary accounts and not eyewitness accounts,
right,
it's impossible
also,
to say.
Also, like,
but
I forgot to mention, the sand boas, body length-wise, match up to about 2 feet.
Do they?
Yes.
All right. Right.
So it's an easy contender to actually be, a mistaken identity.
Well, that could be it. But in any case, that's the Mongolian death worm. I don't have anything more to say about it. And
perfect.
Honestly, I never want to talk about worms again. And the next time I see a worm,
it probably just personifies how dangerous just being in the desert really
is.
Oh,
yeah. Oh, yeah. And then Dune came out and that didn't help anything.
No.
Dune's on my to-be-read shelf. It's been there for a while. I'll read it eventually.
What
What's
shelf
weird,
is that?
It's the shelf on the piano.
Oh, okay.
Actually, yeah. Which reminds me, I don't know, I'm going to do this. If you need any like wood art, I know that sounds like a weird thing to say, but if you're really interested in the way that wood can be used to create art and beautiful things, you should go check out our friend Corey Constable's shop. It's called Hillbound Heathen. He just sent us some, us being me, these beautiful bookends made of wood that are made to look like mountains. And so that's what my shelf is. But he's got all of these great different like wood quilt pattern things. They're fantastic. So if you're in the mood, this is an entirely unpaid advertisement. It is not even an advertisement. If you're in the mood for some beautiful wood, go see Corey. That's all I gotta say. I hope that's fine. In any case, I always say I'm gonna read Dune. It's 800 pages.
Oh, God.
I've already read.
Why?
This month, I will have read, by the end of the day, 700, I want to say, in three different books. But the idea of one 800-page book, I'm like, that's too much. It's too much.
And it's Dune.
And it's Dune. I have a complicated relationship with Dune. But in any case, that's it.
Perfect.
Here we are.
We're done.
At the end of another one of our little journeys into the unknown. And now we're back from the unknown. Guys, remember to, especially if you're one of our $5 or above patrons, please remember to go to Patreon. You can vote for the bonus episode this month. Currently, our options are between Space Penguins, which I don't know what that means, Soulbird, which I don't know what that means, Haunted Hospitals, or Baba Yaga. And Baba Yaga is winning. And I really hope that she continues to win. But on that note, we would like to thank, we got two, I think two, maybe
all
just
that
one.
All that pains me. It really does. All this, like, what would be the best thing to talk about? No, it all hurts. It's all just the worst.
I think we thanked this person last week, but in the grand tradition of
not knowing
this show,
anything,
we're just going to thank him again. So we'd like to thank Lori Fetter. All right, Lori.
I'm pretty
and
sure we did.
But one person I know we didn't thank is Derek Finney.
Woo-hoo! Yeah, Derek.
Thank you guys so much for your support through Patreon. It really just keeps the lights on, keeps us going over here. So we really appreciate that. We also would like to thank, we got a few iTunes reviews. Now, last week, I think we were at like 487.
Oh, man. Are we at 500?
This week, we're at 492.
Oh,
so we are eight away from hitting 500. And like I said last week, even if you don't want to be nice about it, even if you've got serious problems with what we do, go rate us one star. I really don't care. I just want that number to say 500 ratings. So, I mean, ideally, 5 stars is what we would like. You could join the 424 other people who have said this is a 5-star program. So,
but don't let Sam persuade you.
Don't
be honest.
Don't lie to yourself about how much you love our show
and everyone else in the world.
All right. So we'd like to thank Pagan Moon 7, Java Frost 25, Big Bad Green, and Allison LL. Now, here's the thing. I'm going to read Allison's, and here's the thing. I'm going to do something I've never done before, which is read a 4-star review.
Oh, man.
Typically,
oh,
I don't even give them the time of day if they're not 5.
Criticism.
It actually doesn't really have any criticism, so that's fine. Darn. And the reason I'm going to read it is because I deeply identify with what this person is saying. They say, fun podcast, but more ghosts, please. I enjoy this podcast, and the hosts are very funny. I would like more episodes on ghosts, especially stories from the UK and Ireland. Okay.
No, not spooks.
Okay.
Not the spooks.
We really don't do a lot of ghosts.
We're back to the spookernatural.
I really want to do at least one, if not a few, ghost episodes.
All the booze.
So that's going to be our next subject. I don't know what it is exactly yet, but I'm going to find a really good ghost. It may not be from the UK, but I do have a beautiful book called The Lore of Scotland, which has just like 400 pages all about ghosts in Scotland.
Sam, they're just fairies.
Aha. You might be right. But anyway, so thank you for your review and your suggestion. I'm going to take it. I'm going to go find us some cool ghost stories. Other than that, guys, you know how it is. You know what it is. You can find us on Facebook at Not Alone Podcast. You can find us on, I was going to say Instagram. We're there. People keep following us. That's
weird.
Good. Yeah. Same thing like on YouTube. Technically, we're on YouTube.
What?
One of our views has like 10, or one of our let's take a look.
Did you just post audio?
For like 5 episodes I did. Yeah. Let me see here.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, and guess what? YouTube's the worst and it's full of terrible, terrible people. But let me do this here.
Well, yeah, it's the internet.
If I go to
YouTube's like connected to Google. What do you expect?
Okay. So, which one is it? I think it was our one with
Why are we looking this up? We're in the real show, Sam.
I know we're in the real show. Just a sec.
Let's just say the outro and get to the debrief, and then we can talk about how horrible our YouTube experience has been.
Tales of Time Slips, our 15th episode on YouTube, has 11,000 views.
What?
Yeah. All of our other ones have like 300, 400. For some reason, that has 11,000 views. Now, I would like to read to you my absolute favorite, least favorite comment that we've ever received on a YouTube comment. And it is this 1 year ago by Razorface, who says,
"That's scary."
Again, this is on the Tales of Time Slips episode. "You know nothing of that which you seek. Fools you are." So thank you, Razorface. Anyway, theoretically, we're going to be on YouTube soon. How's that going? What do we need to make that happen?
A camera.
What kind of a camera?
And to not be in your storage.
You got a problem with my studio room?
Yeah.
If I clean it, can we be in this room?
Yeah.
Or do you need a different room?
No, we can be in this room.
All right. You just tell me what kind of camera we need. I'll find it. Anyway, Okay. So that's the goal. That's the dream, is to be YouTube stars. Not my dream, Jason's dream. In any case.
What do you think about a green screen?
Like behind us? Yeah. I think that sounds baller.
We can just put ourselves wherever we're going to be.
We are in the desert now. Yeah. Yes. So stay tuned for that eventually. Who knows?
Can we just paint that wall?
Nope. You can find us on.
What about the color green?
You can find us on Twitter at Not Alone Pod. I'm Beerlord Oafbane. Jason is Mighty Moit. And you can join our Facebook group. Remember, we are an Alona community for the strange. Okay. You did a special last week, so you did it last week. I'll do it this week. Remember, whether you find yourself wandering the sand wastes in search of primordial evil, or you awake in the night with a pouch of blood swelling on your back, you are not alone.